members of the AU, we hear that sister country has just adopted a similar bill, and on a lighter note, we've agreed with the department that they will withdraw their bill, and then we will introduce the Kenyan bill and adopt it without discussion. We actually...
I'm not boycotting, I'm coming back here.
I know you are not that type of who believes in boycotts. We have had enough time, all of us, to go through the bill. And I think the difficulty we had last time when the department was addressing us was that we were saying the bill is technical. They had to take us through all the technicalities which we had not digested ourselves, and it was a difficult road. And I guess today it shouldn't be a difficult road. I'm just wondering whether our approach should not be that we take page by page and raise things that we have picked up, or do we want to go through the tortuous presentation? I want to be guided by yourselves. Honorable Horn.
Yes, Chair, I see you and everybody else is sitting with this new version with underlined and words in bold. But if I recall correctly, we were still busy last time round with dealing with departmental responses. So it is a bit of a worry. We didn't nearly finish it last time round. You would recall that you're quite correct in saying that the feeling of the committee and many members were that this is quite technical. Probably we will be in need of some technical guidance. I don't know whether that was sought last time round. And then there was also a sentiment expressed that we're dealing with departmental responses, but we've not yet even had the envisaged joint meeting with police and telecommunications to, before we even get the department's responses, also hear those departments and the specifically the portfolio committee's view on the bill, because this is to an extent overlapping. So I think we will be highly uncomfortable if we now all of a sudden skip to a situation where we just deal with proposed amendments.
Last year, you know, I was like usually, I sit in the plane for 2 hours and I read or write, but today I sat with the former minister, David Masobo, who was involved in the conceptualization and drafting of this bill, and he educated me on it, and he actually suggested that if we had invited him, he would have clarified lots of things, and he clarified my mind. Unfortunately, my mind is not your mind. I'm just wondering whether the department on its own has not had an opportunity to consult with their sister departments, because consultation doesn't necessarily mean that we must meet with the other departments. Can we hear from yourselves? Did you manage to talk to the other departments before you finalize your responses?
Mr. Chairperson, yes. After The State Security Agency, the CRC, the Department of Defense, the National Prosecuting Authority, at the previous time addressed the committee. There were further consultations with the relevant departments. Certain aspects that were raised by the other departments were to an extent addressed in the proposals that we are going to propose further in this bill. So yes, there were consultation. I must just say that all the departments were involved in the drafting of this bill from the start. The drafting of the bill emanated from the Cyber Response Committee. That is a government committee that was put together to deal with cyber security in South Africa. The bill was discussed in that committee. We obtained inputs from all relevant departments that are presented on the CRC. And some of the loose ends, I think, emanated from the presentations that were made to the committee. And that is addressed in this version that is before the committee. I must just point out, yes, most other African countries is in the process or has adopted cyber legislation. I previously pointed out that most legislation is based on international best practices. I did previously point out that the bill to a large extent follow international best practices. And we are of the view that the bill to a large extent is probably all right. Some of the amendments that are proposed in the bill also emanated from discussions that was made during the public consultation process. It was posed as options to current clauses in the bill. It's not that we say that the options in the bill is incorrect and that the additional options should be followed. One must remember that there is various instruments with various definitions that do try to address conduct that is the same. It's just how you go about to address that. I must also point out that the bill was perused by a team of experts. I think Ms. Alison Tilley, who is present today, was part of that group. It consisted out of lower court judicial officers who made a substantial input. Mr. Jason Jordan was also part of that group. A person like Mr. Cesare Snail also gave substantial inputs on the bill. And the bill, as introduced, was more or less a kind of agreed version. Although Ms. Tilley didn't agree with some aspects, I think the working group, to a large extent, thought that this was a product that can be used to address the current lacuna in South African legislation.
I have also been in discussion with the minister and deputy minister, and I can confirm that what is said on the process has taken place, and that therefore we are in a better position now to proceed without a joint meeting with the sister departments, unless we want to duplicate efforts. So, honorable members, I would propose that honorable Leon.
No, Chair, but I think the point is missed. We've never said that there was not input from multiple departments in the drafting of this. What the argument last time around was is to say that the portfolio committees of police and telecommunications also has an interest and quite possibly a duty in respect of this bill, because it's not, even though it was introduced by the Minister of Justice, it's not purely a justice bill. And to now say that we must be at ease because the departments of police and telecommunications were heavily involved in the drafting is negating the possible enrichment that could be brought to the process by our fellow legislatures serving on those portfolio committees.
I think there's a middle way that as this committee we go through the responses and then we can say maybe phase two, then we consider sitting with the other committees, because if we say we want to sit with other committees before we ourselves even go through the responses, it may be a way of running away from our responsibilities. So I hear your point. Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But we can all read these responses. It's not necessary to have them read for us. And I think the other committee should have the same opportunity to go through these responses, and then we should still have that meeting with the other committees. That's the decision we took. On what basis are we now deviating from that decision?
Honorable Breitenbach, last time we stopped midway. So all I'm saying now is that let's complete the process that we had started. And then when we have completed that process, then we can take a decision whether or not we still need to meet with the other committees, and of course taking into account the program of Parliament. That's what I'm saying.
The program of Parliament is the problem.
Pardon?
Is the program of Parliament the problem?
I'm not saying it's a problem. I say taking it into account at the end of our process here, we have to take it into account, because we don't do the programming of Parliament. We will have to look at the program of Parliament and look at the programs of the other committees and see how we fit in these processes.
Yes, because as far as I can recall, Mr. Chair, that decision has already been taken, that we would meet with them. So I would like to know what basis we're reviewing that decision.
Okay, if... Honorable Mutapo.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I also propose that we give the department officials time to talk to the responses, and where there will be clarity-seeking questions, then we ask them. Then later, we will interact with other portfolio committees as proposed. But now we move forth and take responses from the department, and maybe we have, if we there are clarifying questions and so forth, then we take it from.
Honorable members, I don't think that we disagree. I think now we are in the process of taking responses from the department. So can we proceed in that fashion?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I believe the last time we stopped at clause 14. Clause 14 is...
Sorry, Chair, I don't want to be rude. I just want to get clarity. I still have with me a document, 26 February, and there I've marked where we ended more or less on page 37. Can we just be informed? I see this new document now as 26 February and then 22 May 2018 final. Whether anything was changed on the first 37 pages which we dealt with when we last met?
That's a fair question, and also it shows that you are following the processes meticulously, and that's what we expect as a committee. Can we be clarified on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Nothing has changed as was discussed previously. The document was revised. Meetings took place with the South African police and new comments were inserted, but that relates to other clauses that still needs to be discussed. And also the formatting changed due to the fact that I use computers with different operating systems. So in general, what was discussed up till now is the same. I haven't changed anything in the document. There is some other minor amendments that is affected in what I am going to be discussed further. Can I proceed then, Mr. Chairperson? I believe at the last stage we end roundabout at clause 14. It's the sentencing option. On the new document, that is on page 14.
Can you maybe assist us by, really, because where there are options, give us the preferred option so that we don't have to discuss everything that we must discuss, the preferred options.
I will do that, Mr. Chairperson. On the new document, it actually starts on page 42. Penalties and sentencing on page 42. We propose that the heading to that clause be amended to deal with sentencing and not penalties. The reason is that clause 14 does not per se only deal with penalties but also prescribes certain circumstances that must be taken into account when a person is sentenced. On page 43, there is an amendment proposed to clause 5, and that is to insert the offence of theft into that clause. That must also be considered as an aggravating circumstance. I believe the whole clause referred to all the other offences that is already catered for in the bill, but theft was excluded since the bill does not per se create an offence of cyber theft. So, and it is an option that the department will like to see that this is affected to subclause 5. On page 44, we're still busy with clause 14. There's an addition of a subclause 7 that deals with let's call it on page 44. It makes a provision that a court may order that if a criminal is convicted of an offence that he must pay back the money that he stole or any damage that was suffered by a victim. It is correct, Section 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act can cater for this. However, what we do in this clause is to make it an obligatory order that must be considered by the court. Section 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act is not obligatory. I believe the victim of that offence must request the prosecutor that order can be made and that he be reimbursed for losses suffered. There's other legislation in the statute book that similarly deal with obligatory compensation orders. I did refer in footnote 48 to that legislation. It's amongst others the Stock Theft Act and Game Theft Act. This must be drawn back to the comment we received from a person that if a person is convicted of an offence, all damages that were suffered must be paid by that person. So it's mainly giving effect to that comment. According to the department, it's probably not necessary to insert this clause here since Section 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act do deal with this aspect. But it is something that can be considered since there's already other clauses on the statute book that deals with obligatory compensation orders. On page 45, we deal with competent verdicts. That is, this clause sets out competent verdicts that a court may impose if a person is charged with an offence. A cosmetic change is affected to the clause as a whole, merely to further clarify that if a person is not convicted of an offence that is mentioned in this clause, and we insert the words or a contravention of section 12 in respect of that offence, which deal with participation in crime, attempt, incitement, then the competent verdicts should follow. So in that regard, it's merely it further clarifies the clause. On page 46 and right through this clause, where we refer to a contravention of section 4.2, one must remember that we previously did make a proposal to the committee that the distribution, advertising, development and use of listed equipment should not be criminalized in terms of clause 4, and that be omitted. This whole clause do take that into account, and where we refer to section 4.2, that should now be read as section 4.1. Further, on page 47, where we deal with subclause 5, certain further amendments are affected to the clause, mainly to clarify the clause in respect of the offences that is competent verdicts. The same is followed in respect of subclause 6 on page 47.
Honourable members, I'm not looking at you. I'm looking at the document. So shout at me. I won't be offended. And I guess the Mr. Roberts won't be offended as well. Proceed.
I mentioned that if to an extent the substantial is on clause on page 58, where we propose that
in subclause 6, the item that is marked as 3 should be omitted, and that a new paragraph C should be inserted to deal with a contravention of section 7.1 and 7.2, and specifically insofar as that password access codes, etc., relates to the purpose for contravening clause 8, which deals with fraud. 7.1 and 2 is mainly the acquiring of passwords, use, possession thereof, and the reference to section 7.2 implies that a person is in possession of certain passwords in respect to of which there is a reasonable suspicion that an offence has been committed, and a person is unable to give a satisfactory account of the possession of that password. I'm going to skip forward to page 49. Subclause 8 is merely a further clarification where we refer to section 11, 1. It's according to the department not necessary to refer to section 315.1. 7.1 as contemplated in section 11.1. Section 11.1 already defined offences with reference to that section. The same apply to subclause 9, where certain offences that is already in a prescription of clause 11.2 is removed from the clause. Omission probably from the part of the department is that a similar clause that is in the Criminal Procedure Act, and that provides that if a person is charged with the offence, but the charge does not prove the offence, but proof an offence which by means of its elements is substantially similar to the offence, the person can be convicted of such an offence. We do make provision, therefore, where we on page 49 add subclause 10 to the competent verdict clause. I must stress this. Before a person can be convicted of competent verdicts, he should usually be informed beforehand that he can be convicted of competent verdicts on the offence on which he is charged. If a court does not warn a person, it will amount to irregularity. In practice, it usually happens that prosecutors usually charge a person with a lot of alternative charges, but it may happen that there is some kind of oversight. This whole clause just probably makes it easier to ensure that a person can be convicted of various other offences that is similar to which to the offence of which he is charged. Okay, that's the end of chapter 2. That's mainly the offences and sentencing part. The next chapter I'm going to deal with is chapter 3, that deals with malicious communications. I think this is also the chapter that received the most comments in general. There was some criticism, etc. I'm not going to discuss that, but I'm going to concentrate on the text. So on page 50 of the document, a definition clause is proposed to further clarify certain terminology that is used in respect of the offences as set out in clauses 16, 17 and 18. I'm going to discuss that if I take the committee through the respective clauses. On page 51, a data message which incites damage to property or violence, two proposals is proposed. First, in the heading, the word intentionally is inserted, and at the end of that clause, the reference to group of persons is further prescribed as identifiable group of persons. And identifiable groups of persons is further prescribed or defined in the proposed definition clause as a group of persons that may be identified, with reference to, amongst others, association, nationality, religion, conscience, belief, status, etc. I believe it was a concern that was raised during a public consultation process that the word group of persons is wide and it needs to be defined, and we aim to give effect there too. On page 51, deals with a data message that is harmful. We don't propose any amendments to the current clause, but we do propose additional options. The first option is on page 52, where we again deal with this offence. To a large extent, it's mainly a redraft of the current clause 17. However, on page 53, we unpack the conduct against a group of persons insofar as it relates to threats that is made against that group of persons. On page 53, paragraph C, that deals with harmful communications. The only amendment that is proposed, or some of the amendments that's proposed to that clause, is that we substitute the word encourages with the word coerces. I think it's a more stronger action that is required than encourages. And we also substitute the word harm with words to the effect that act of violence must be, a person must be intimidated, harassed, etc., to commit an act of violence against himself or another person, or cause damage to property belonging to himself or another person. In the definitions clause that is proposed on page 50, violence is defined, amongst others, as bodily injury as well as unwanted sexual conduct, or rather unwanted conduct of a sexual nature that offends, intimidates, or humiliates. In this clause, we excise the false communication clause. And sorry, I did I was on page 50, then I bounced back to page 53. On page 50 was the definitions of violence, which include
On page 51, on A, violence means it appears the conduct that is likely to cause, but to cause, has been deleted.
Well, it's... thank you, honourable members. If you read it in context of the prescription, it says threatens a person with violence. So threatens a person with bodily injury is probably one way how you can put it. I did not remove that. I strike it through, since you can use the word threatens a person with conduct that is likely to cause bodily harm. So this is just for consideration in the finalization of the bill, so we can use either one or the other. My option that I would prefer is the one without a strike through, the whole word, conduct, that is likely to cause bodily injury. During the public consultation process, a lot of adverse comments were received on the fake clause, the fake news clause in the bill. What we did try to do is to redraft the old clause and to build in certain belts and braces to ensure that it cannot be unfairly be used to prosecute a person. And it was also considered during the public consultation process that this clause is to a large extent very vague. So the new proposed offence on page 54, amongst others, still criminalise the distribution, make available of a data message, which is false. And then we go on, in sub-clause 2, we do define when a data message is false, and according to this proposal, a data message is false if it's inherently false in nature. That's similar as the current clause. And it's made available, broadcast, or distributed with the aim to cause mental, psychological, physical, or economic harm to a person or identifiable group of person. And further, it is not honestly held opinion, which is dealt with at the bottom of page 54, or an artistic creative performance or other form of expression as defined in subclause 4. And then it's subject to the reasonable person test. We must regard the whole data message with regard to all these factors as false. And on subclause 4 on page 55, we do define artistic creativity, a performance or other form of expression as any bona fide artistic creativity, performance or other form of expression that is not aimed at causing mental, physical, psychological or economic harm to a specific person or identifiable group of persons. On page 55, subclause 3, assist a victim further. First, the whole clause is subject to approval of the prosecution by the National Director of Public Prosecutions, as is referred to in subclause 3A. And then in B we say that even if the Director of Public Prosecutions does not give consent, the victim to this type of malicious communications can still apply for the protection orders that are set out in clause 19 of the bill. Alternatively, in terms of the Protection of Harassment Act.
Mr. Roberts, you refer to the national director, but the bill itself refers to the Director of Public Prosecution. Is that a...
The bill do refer in some instances to the National Director of Public Prosecutions.
You just said it needs permission from the National Director.
The Director of Public Prosecutions having jurisdiction. It's usually it's different, you know how it works. Yeah. Okay. Then on page 55, the clause that deals with the distribution of an intimate image without consent, we did receive a lot of comment on this clause, and I think comments were received to the effect that we must deal with new developments internationally, and that we should not only criminalize nude images of a person that is being distributed, but that we should also deal with other types of intimate images, amongst others, upskirt shots, down blues, photos, creep shots, etc. And the redraft of the clause do give effect to that, but there were also other comments that were made. First, during the public consultation process, we were requested to change the wording where the person that distributed data message in the original clause, it do provide that the person that distributes a data message without the permission of a person is guilty of an offence. But there were comments to the effect that we must change the clause to the effect that the word knows that consent has not been given should be replaced with to the effect that the person, or rather criminal liability will follow unless the perpetrator knows that consent has been given. So it's difficult to explain this on this thing. But previously it was to the effect that if a person distributes a data message He did not obtain the permission of a person, he would have been guilty of an offence. Currently, we propose amendment to the wording to the effect that the perpetrator will be guilty of the offence if he distributes the data message and he knows consent has not been given. It's a fine line, but the preferred wording on page 56 was probably something that the department will accept as a preferable option. The definition of intimate image on page 56 is further amended to provide for the upskirt shots, down blue shots, etc. And there's also amendment to the privacy expectation on at the bottom of page 56. We changed the wording on the circumstances that give rise to a reasonable expectation of privacy to the words in respect of which the person so depicted retains a reasonable expectation of privacy at the time the data message was made. And then we do define person due to the fact that during a public consultation process there was a lot of comment about harmful communications that was distributed where the person is not ipso facto identifiable from the harmful communication, but he can be described as being identified or surrounding circumstances can be used to identify that person. And that definition gives effect to this comments. I must, however, point out that persons already identified in clause 1, so we probably need to relook at the definition of person in clause 1 to ensure that there is not a clash with definitions that's defined otherwise in the other clauses.
On the top of my page 57, so clause 18.2a(bb). A(bb). The person's covered genital or anal region in the case of a female or her breasts is displayed in an unduly manner. That doesn't make any sense. I know what unduly means. That sentence is displayed in an unduly manner that violates or offends the sexual integrity or dignity of the unduly is out of place there and it makes no sense. So you may just want to have a look at that.
We will consider it, but displayed...
It's an incorrect word, believe me. English is my first language.
Shouldn't we, if we think it's an incorrect word, propose what we think is correct?
Or take out unduly and then it's fine.
Okay. We're fine. Proceed.
Okay. Then on page 57 to 58, there's another proposal to deal with intimate images. The option is to a large extent similar to the previous option, that is the first option that was discussed. We do try to clarify a reference to the perpetrator and the victim. I refer to them as A and B, similar to the Sexual Offences Act. However, there's a new type of offence that is proposed, and that is in clause 18.2, and that deals with where the perpetrator threatens a person, a member of the family of the victim or a person in close relationship with the victim that intimate image will be distributed as contemplated in the bill. That is probably an option that can be followed if we deal with harmful disclosure of pornography in the schedule to the bill. There is an offence that is substantially similar to subclause 2. From a point of preference, the previous option is probably the option that the department will stand by with changing of the word unduly. But this is just to expand on the current prescription. It can be considered. Regarding the rest of this chapter, during the public consultation process, there were no real criticism against the procedural part of this chapter. I believe there was a concern regarding the penalties, and there were requests that the penalties be increased as contemplated in clause 22 of the bill. The department indicated that no, the penalties is fine, 3 years is adequate for this type of offence. But on page 66, there is a proposal that can be considered. Usually during, it happens under the Protection of Harassment Act on a frequent basis, that a complainant applies for a protection order. But in order to get to the real perpetrator, she must apply for several type of protection orders. Sometimes up to 10 orders at a cost of around 200 and something rand per direction that is issued in terms of Protection of Harassment Act. And before she can actually identify the perpetrator. This clause aims to ensure that if a person is convicted of malicious communication, that the victim must be reimbursed by the perpetrator. And further, the proposed subclause 6 also provides that the perpetrator must compensate the service providers to remove or disable malicious communications, which sometimes do involve substantial actions by a service provider. I think that this is a reasonable option that should be included in the bill. We now at the end of chapter 3, going to deal with chapter 4. Chapter 4 mainly deals with jurisdiction. The basis of the expanded jurisdiction is to deal with the transnational nature of cybercrime. During the public consultation process, the clause was supported. However, when the South African Police Services addressed the committee, as well as the other departments, certain proposals were made to amend the committee. The first amendment is on page 69, and that is to the effect that the financial institution and the critical information infrastructure should specifically be included in the clause. The effect thereof will be that if an offence is committed against a financial institution or critical information infrastructure, extraterritorial jurisdiction will vest in the offence or the conduct. However, the South African Police Services did request the committee to consider a clause which is discussed on page 70, that the National Director of Public Prosecutions must issue certain prescripts to further clarify or rather instruct the police how investigations should be conducted if it originates from outside the Republic, as well as the agencies that should conduct such an investigation. I believe their concern was South African police work in kind of regions. If a crime is committed in a region, it's fine, then that the police officials of that region will investigate a crime. But if it originates from outside the country, there's usually not an identifiable region. So to accommodate this request, the clause is proposed by the addition of sub-clause 6. Well, from the department's point of view, we can probably leave the clause in, but according to us, it's probably not necessary. But to accommodate the South African police services, let's leave it in.
Sorry, I don't follow. How is the National Director of Public Prosecutions going to issue prescripts to the police? In terms of what?
I believe if you look in at the international, the ICC Act, there is a clause that do deal with certain prescripts that can be issued by the National Director relating to the investigation of crime that originate obviously outside the borders of the Republic. I think the concern of the police is mainly the same. I did try to explain it. That there is no, if a cybercrime originates from outside the boundaries and that affects, let's say, an institution in the Republic, which does not have, let's say, a specific place or a presentation at a specific place or have a presentation right to the country, it will be very difficult for the South African police to investigate that type of offences.
Mm-hmm.
So the directives that must be issued is merely to stipulate that how the South African Police Service must investigate that crimes, probably which units must be used, at which place or at which region or which police official at the region must investigate.
And these are instructions, I'm sorry to interrupt you, being given by the National Director of Public Prosecution.
Well, it's authorized in terms of this act now, so it can be given.
And why is it not better to say that the National Commission of Police would issue these instructions in consultation with the National Director of Public Prosecutions? I feel deeply uncomfortable with the prosecution authority giving directions to police. It's an anathema in the way we practice criminal law.
Well, as is indicated, the department do agree to the effect that a national commissioner or the head of the DPCI should actually issue the instructions.
Yes, well,
regarding your proposal, it's acceptable. Yeah. You just swing it around.
I'm happy for the national director to be consulted. I'm not happy for him to be issuing the instructions.
Fine.
We're still together. We're happy with that adjustment. Yes, proceed.
Thank you, Mrs. Chairperson. Okay, dealing with Chapter 5, it deals with the power to investigate, search, access, and seize. But in general, I think during a public consultation process, this chapter was supported. There were concerns that there may be some kind of undue influence on the right to privacy. Most people pointed out that the current Criminal Procedure Act is completely non-suitable for cyber investigations. Some people also see Chapter 5 as an extension of the RICO, which it is definitely not. I'm going to jump to standard operating procedures. I think the only concern here was that the police request extension of the 6 months period to a period of 18 months. That is on page 71. My submission is 6 months is probably all right. The police also requested that standard operating procedures should not be made publicly available. The department's take on the matter is that standard operating procedures should be made available.
Thank you. I'm not sure which clause you're on. I'm on...
Clause 24, it's page 71.
Yeah, well, that's exactly where I am. How fortunate. The cabinet member responsible for policing, in consultation with the National Director of Public Prosecutions and the cabinet member responsible for the administration of justice, must, after following a process of public consultation within 6 months, issue standard operating procedures. Is there a particular reason why the Commission of Police is not included in that little group of people?
Well, the cabinet member responsible for policing is the head of...
the minister.
Yeah.
He's not the commissioner of police.
No, but you don't if you deal with subordinate legislation, you cannot in legislation give the national commissioner the powers, in most instances, to enact subordinate legislation. My submission is that standard operating procedures, although not called regulations, is something in the form of subordinate legislation. It must be published in the Gazette. My submission is, since the Minister of Police is the head of the Department of Police, he has got political oversight over the South African police, and in terms of this...
But you invite the National Director of Public Prosecutions along with the Minister of Justice.
This is a mere consultation process.
I want to know why the Commissioner of Police isn't there. I think he's entitled to be there. It's his business.
Ipso facto, he will be involved.
No, it doesn't say so. He's excluded. I would like him to be included.
I'm not going to argue, but generally, it's similar to the Minister of Justice must make regulations,
and then must we include the DG of Justice?
When the Minister of Justice makes regulations that regard his department, that's just fine. But what you're doing here is you're including the National Director in an issue that involves largely the police, and you're excluding his rank equivalent in the police. I see no reason for it.
Well, the reason is the National Prosecuting Authority is only the Prosecuting Authority, and they will deal with evidence, etc. So it's essential that they must be involved.
I agree, and I think it's essential that the Commissioner of Police is also involved.
Well, I'll put it in, but it's...
agreement that should be, especially those who are in touch with the Kenyan situation. Can you tell us what the Kenyans are doing in that regard?
I can get back to you, Chairperson. I can't tell you off the top of my head.
I think it's an administrative prescript that is issued.
Yeah. Okay.
And 38(1) and 38(2) of this Act and the other legislation can only search and seize the virtue of the search way. Decision of reference to section 58.1 and 58.2. To clarify the conceit, the perception that the record can be used, or rather this act can be used to deal with matters that falls within the domain of the record. Section 58.1 and 58.2 of this act, we'll go to that later on, deals or rather stipulates that in the section of call content and call related information must take place in terms of the record in the story. You cannot use any other legislation to do this. So this further clarifies the clause and ensure that it can never ever be interpreted to authorize a magistrate to issue a warrant for a person to grab information at the Tower of Electronic Communications Service provider.
So that is the main amendment to that clause.
Chair, I just want to go a few steps back to, I think, it's footnote 74 on my page 71. And now, well, along the lines of what was said just now, the NPA there requested for the authority to deal with remote searches, and the department's response, which I understand along the line of what was said just now, is that this should be dealt with by way of an amendment to RICA. The only problem I have with that is, given the fact that we as Parliament are not that agile in dealing with concurrent amendments, won't the failure to at least not preclude remote searches by way of this bill not create a problem in the medium term, at least?
I'll respond to that. Remote access tools is the same actions of a hacker or a cyber criminal, where the state install certain software on a computer device or use that to access a computer system to retain certain information. It has got transnational implications as well. South Africa can probably hack Moscow and get all the information under judicial authority if that is used. To deal with remote access tools, I will be very hesitant to include it in a bill that mainly deals with search and seizure of stored data. The Department of Justice is also dealing with the RICO, and we are currently busy revising the RICO, and I can assure you that that aspect is addressed. My submission is it must be under the strict control regime of the RICO if such enactment is on the statute book and should not be made in terms of this bill. To a large extent, yes, it may help to facilitate the investigation of cybercrime. I believe the IRIS bill, cyber bill, the last one that was made available in bill form, do provide for that. New Zealand legislation specifically do provide for remote access tools as well as UK legislation. But the safeguards that must be adhered to are substantial. I must also remember the bill was subject to extreme criticism. So a very cautionary approach is taken in the provisions of the bill. And let's really leave it for Rika.
Well,
not necessarily. I just feel if we deal with...
The department is aware of that concern, and they are explaining how it's being dealt with. So I think we should be able to live with that.
You say so. I just feel, Jay, if we acting in the cyber world to now tell the police that they can only access whatever data is stored if they are able to go to where it is physically stored will really tie their hand behind their back.
A comment on
yes, Mr. Chairperson. Okay, first, police is not tied down specifically in terms of the bill. Well, first, they may be tied down to a specific place. But a warrant can obviously authorize them to conduct a remote or connected computer search. That is usually where I access this device, but I find out the data is actually stored in a Dropbox completely outside the computer. They can do that. That can be done by conventional methods. That's usually not a problem. You can merely access this device and retain data that's stored elsewhere. But if you use remote access tools, that is similar to surveillance. There is authorization. The person may not even know that a warrant has been issued. There's a big potential for abuse. Yes, it can substantially further cybercrimes investigations. But even in legislation of other countries, in the UK, remote access tools is dealt with under the Investigatory Powers Act of 2016. That is the interception legislation. If you look at the New Zealand legislation, that clause is also dealt with in terms of the interception part of the Search and Seizure Act. Australia similarly is dealt with under mostly the surveillance legislation. It's not in the cyber provisions.
So in the interpretation of that clause, we have other comparative solutions to revert to.
Well, Mr. Chairperson, if the Honourable Member do think that it should be inserted, or if he can provide some input in that regard to the national safeguards.
I think I will be at ease if I could be just explained. Maybe I'm just too stupid to understand. If we, by accessing this computer, are able to also access data on another computer linked to that computer, isn't that some sort of remote access tool we in any event using?
No, that is not a traditional meaning of remote access tool. That is a connected computer search. It means that I can use this device and access anything that's connected to that device, including your Dropbox, your user accounts, where you store data elsewhere. That is not remote access tools. That is remote access from a computer, but it relates to a computer and everything connected to the computer. Remote access tools are different. It's like I sit somewhere, email something to you, you open it up, it unfolds in your computer, and then it retains all your data and sends everything back to me. That is a remote access tool. It's a cyber crime that's sanctioned by the state.
So, just a question of clarification. I think it has been clearly clarified. Proceed.
Mr. Mr. Chairperson, I'm going to jump to page 80 and to deal with
Sorry, I'm jumping to page 79. It's clause 30. That deals with search for access and seizure of article involved in the commission of an offence. On page 80, the next page, the word oral is excised from that clause. It's excised due to the fact that the police proposed that oral applications must be excised. The department are, however, opposed to this. The reason is, it will be explained later when we deal with the next clause 31. So I'll leave it there and deal with clause 31 now. Clause 31 is on page 80. The clause provides that police officials may, without a search warrant, as contemplated in section 40 of the Criminal Procedure Act, arrest the person who commits an offence. They may then search and seize a person, and they may take possession of certain devices that is in his possession. But then, dual safeguard is built into this clause. First, it tells the police official, if you find a device on a person, you cannot access it, but you can safeguard it. You can take that cell phone and put it in a Faraday bag. The information on that cellular device or laptop computer can only access if there is an application for a warrant. But in the clause, there's also exigent circumstances provision that says if there is exigent circumstances, the police official is of the opinion that a warrant in terms of section 27 will be given to him, and there's no time to make application for a section 27 warrant or oral application of that warrant, that police official may access the device. Okay, the police indicate as follows. They're opposed to oral applications for warrants. They refer to the RICO legislations which do provide for oral applications for interception warrants, and they indicate that that has not been very successful. I must, however, indicate that in terms of the bill, there's provisions that, unlike the RICO legislation, certain prescripts must be issued in terms of the cyber bill by the Chief Justice how to deal with oral applications. So my submission is oral applications is a necessity and must stay. Secondly, the police wants to revert back to the Criminal Procedure Act. And in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, the police official may, without a warrant, search and seize a person, search a person, seize an article that is in possession of a person. An article is defined in the Criminal Procedure Act as anything that's involved in offence can be used as evidence that a crime has been committed, etc. And then section 23(2) of the Criminal Procedure Act says that if something is found on a person or article that is not involved in a commission of offence, the police must put it in safe custody. The police argue that section 23(1) gives them powers when they arrest a person on a reasonable suspicion that they may access any device in his possession. And they did refer previously to the case of State versus Miller. That was a recent case in 2015. It just said that, yes, the police can, where they arrest the person, access a cell phone. If there's a suspicion that it falls within definition of an article in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act. In other words, it must involve an offence, it must can provide evidence regarding the offence, etc. So in general, the police want access to the device if they arrest the person, and we are opposed to that. In the document, it starts round about on page 81, and it ends on the bottom of page 84. I did set out the international position. First, in Canada, there's three decisions that says if the police want to access a computer device, a warrant is a prerequisite. It also tells you that the computer is not just an ordinary implement. It's a separate receptacle as such as a house, and you need a warrant to do that. A limited exception was, however, recognized in Canada in the R versus Fearon case, where the police was allowed to access a cellular phone. But again, the basis for that was, amongst others, that there was a reasonable suspicion that it may give evidence of the commission of an offence. The case is discussed at the bottom of page 83 with 84, and I think I did highlight the relevant part in italics. United States, I think the Riley versus California case is the latest classicus on that, and they say a warrant is necessary unless there is certain exceptions under which the police is authorized to access a device, a cellular phone. And obviously, one of those exceptions will be if there's a reasonable suspicion that it is involved in an offense or can provide evidence. Australia, the same. New Zealand is the same. In the UK, it's basically the same. In general, you need a warrant. But if there's a reasonable suspicion that a computer device is involved in an offence, yes, you may go forward. So my submission is that the current clause is adequate. Although it imposes a double safeguard on the police, it does not hamper the police. One must remember that the article is also defined similarly to the Criminal Procedure Act. If a South African police officials of the opinion that on reasonable grounds that the computer is involved in the offence and he has the right to arrest the person under this bill or the Criminal Procedure Act, he can act, he can more or less seize the computer, make it secure. However, if there is exigent circumstances and he cannot apply for an access warrant, he can go on, but he's then there's a dual burden on him to prove that he was justified to access the computer device. So my submission is we should retain this clause in toto as well as not excise oral applications.
Thank you. Mr. Roberts, it may be dealt with elsewhere in the bill, but I don't recall. What type of police official are we talking about here? Any police official.
Any police official. Really? You do not want to give them that powers. I believe
no, 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 I don't disagree with that. I'm just concerned that if your local constable from the local police station accesses a computer, because he believes he has a right to do so and he believes there are exigent circumstances, he may destroy any opportunity for using evidence that actually does exist. A, by destroying the chain of evidence, or B, just making such a hash of it. And that's my only concern, that you may lose evidence that was really reasonably accessible but has now been destroyed. Is there some way of dealing with that?
Yes, the bill do deal with that. Well, first, I think the standard operating procedures will go a long way to address this. That is something that's quite essential. Provision is made in the next clause, I believe, provision is in the bill that the police official may arrest a person, let's say under clause 31, that he may appoint an investigator, amongst others, to assist him with the investigation and to deal with the evidence that is seized. Okay, I'm going to jump to page 85. It relates to clause 32, and the clause specifies that persons in control of computer systems must assist the police in the investigations of cybercrime if they are authorized to conduct such an investigation. At the bottom of the page, the only amendment that originated from the public consultation process is that of the electronic communication service providers, who insisted that the word reasonable be inserted in paragraph B, so that it can more or less qualify such other assistance. I haven't got a problem with that. Mr. Chairperson, there were certain minor amendments which I'm not going to discuss. Up until page 90, prohibition of disclosure of information. Even there, there's on page 91, where there is in clause 37.1d amendments proposed to that sub-clause. Let me explain the amendments. This emanated as a result of the discussions that took place in the committee between the various departments, and some of the departments feel more comfortable if the words competent authorities is inserted in that clause. In general, what happens is this clause prohibits the disclosure of any information of a cyber investigation. The reason is obviously if cyber criminal or his pal knows that there's an investigation, he will just remotely wipe all traces and evidence. So to ensure that the police does not publish his investigations or make it known to other persons, which can have such an adverse result, there's a general prohibition on the disclosure of information. However, the clause do make exceptions where information sharing is where information sharing is carved out from this prohibition, and one of the carve-out provisions that we propose to be inserted, and we do agree with that, is competent authorities. Competent authorities is mainly can be the certs of various countries or even certs in the private sectors that share information about cybersecurity incidents. I believe in terms of the Twin Peaks legislation and prescripts that is applicable to financial institutions, there's a general obligation to monitor cybersecurity, and information sharing is very necessary in that regard. Furthermore, we also include the word detecting. That is something that must be excluded from the absolute prohibition, and that's on page 91. And then on page 92, we just qualify reference to competent authority here to that of a competent authority in a foreign state. since we used competent authority unqualified now in the previous paragraph. Okay, clause 38. Clause 38 aims to clarify the operation of the Act vis-à-vis the RICO legislation. And in terms of this clause, I already explained 38.1 and 38.2 stipulates that content data must be intercepted in terms of RICO, and real-time communication related information must be intercepted in terms of the RICO end of story. You cannot deviate from that process. However, certain small cosmetic amendments are affected to 38.1. It's not necessary to refer to interception direction. You can just refer to the clause, sections 16.4 and 18.3 of the RICO in clause 38.1. Same with subclause 2. We don't need to refer to real-time communication-related direction here because it's already spelled out in terms of section 73 and 18.3 of the RICO.
Chairperson, but it appears there is a thin membrane, not such differences between RICO and this bill in terms of this section 38. Am I wrong?
The bill mainly relates to the seizure of stored data. RICO relates to, first, to the interception of communications. That is where me and X communicates with each other, and somebody, while the communication is travel over the communication line, duplicate the communication and keep it. The other thing which RICO prohibits is obviously when we talk to each other over a line, there's other information that goes with that. In terms of the RICO, that is defined as real-time communication-related information, which clarifies the origin, amongst others, destination, where you are when you make the communication. In terms of RICO, that is prohibited if it's provided on an ongoing basis. The bill can never be used to obtain that type of communication. The bill can also not be used to get archive communication related information. That is information that is stored by a service provider. You call Billings. On 3 years back you made a call to Mr. X. And they keep records of that. That cannot be obtained in terms of this bill. You cannot. You must use RICO. This bill caters for stored data, what is on the hard drive of a computer. A program or data on the hard drive. It does not cater for interception at all.
A useful clarification, and on that basis, the humanitarian committee secretary next to me thinks that I'm keeping you for too long without allowing you to have water and have a short break. Can we have a 5 minutes break and come back? Yeah?
Maybe afterwards.
I'm deliberately going to say, in fact, like, what about members of the I prefer to be invited.
Thank you.